Happy Daylight Savings Time and happy International Women's Day. Well, on the subject of women, you might have noticed that now in 2020, not a single woman is running for president. And since the founding of our democracy, no woman has ever become president, even though there are about 166 million females in the United States compared with 159 males. Come to think of it, there would be even more women in America if they weren't murdered each year by men who had abused them. One out of three women who are murdered is killed by an intimate partner. Sorry. Although these deaths had declined some since the 1800s, they were on the rise again as federal law, the Violence Against Women Act, has expired and its renewal lies blocked by the Republican majority in the Senate. For instance, the number of women murdered by their intimate partner rose from the previous average of about 1,000 a year to 1,521 in the year 2017. And the key to this rise in mortality is the abuser's access to guns. The National Rifle Association put forth its money and power to block reauthorization of that Violence Against Women Act because it bans guns for abusers. Well, why and how these deaths happen has questions and answers at so many levels. So often people ask, well, if she was being abused, why didn't she leave? The answer is that at least half the homicides that woman had separated from or divorced the murderer, or she was in process of leaving. She's twice as likely to be killed when she's leaving. And people ask, well, don't shelters for battered women end abuse and the risk of death? The answer is no. She's much more likely to be stalked and murdered if she escapes to a shelter. The killer will stalk her. He'll either find his way to the shelter or find his way to her workplace or anywhere that she absolutely needs to go. Oftentimes, the abuser gets shared custody of their children, and he kills her when she delivers the kids to their meeting place. And some observers ask, well, what did she do to make her husband or her boyfriend so angry? They assume that the victim herself, it must have been her provocative behavior that caused her partner's violent assaults. The answer is that the partner's violence is just part of his deliberate actions to take control over the woman in his life. In one case, whenever his wife's friends or family came to visit, the abuser was rude and insulting, so they all dropped away. Her husband took control of what clothes she could wear. He threw out what he didn't like. He criticized her weight. He discouraged her pursuit of a career and ridiculed her in public. He called her my idiot wife. His beatings had purpose, not some sudden, spontaneous rage. When a husband or a boyfriend has this level of control, and the woman gets her first beating, it's extremely rare for her to tell anybody. She begins to ask for help after the fourth or later beatings, as violence has escalated and her life feels threatened. Some people ask, well, why can't she get a gun to protect herself? Well, that's what the National Rifle Association recommends. And the answer is, when a woman shoots the abuser to defend her life, most often she's charged and convicted of manslaughter. Well, how about our legal system? Is there help out there? We have police, prosecutors, and judges who are there to protect the lives and property of all of us. What happens if the abused woman calls the police? So often, the police take little or no evidence and file no report, or the report is suppressed. In California, a neighbor phoned the police one night when she heard screaming. The police arrived and found a young woman in the parking area with a baby in her arms. She'd been beaten about the head and bleeding. She described how her ex-boyfriend had stalked her, broken into her apartment, and beaten and dragged her out to his truck. It turned out that her abuser was a famous football star at the local university. The supervisor back at the police station buried the police report because they were not going to destroy the reputation of a popular sports star. But supposing the police do their work, what happens next? According to most state laws, a police report of domestic violence goes to a judge. The judge hears the testimony of the victim, and a temporary restraining order, or protective order, they're called both, restraining or protective, is issued. This is a civil order, not a criminal one. But many restraining orders are never served because the abuser hides out or manages to avoid service. And in some jurisdictions, it's the woman, the victim, who has to pay for a processor to serve the order. Lack of service has its consequences. Sheila Nash of Bowling Green, Kentucky, was granted a protective order in 2015 when Gary Thompson threatened to burn down her apartment. He had broken into her home before. That restraining order had still never been served when he was charged with shooting and killing her that year. In Seattle, Washington, police failed to serve at least 40% of protective orders. When the abuser is served and then violates that order, no matter. Typically, the charges are dismissed. One abuser in Ohio violated that restraining order 9 times. Then the worst happened. He got 17 days in jail. 1 in 5 homicide victims had a valid protective order when they were murdered. An interesting case came up in a Midwestern city. That victim called the police to report that her ex-husband was violating the restraining order. The abuser was still there when the police arrived, but the police wouldn't arrest him because, quote, he hadn't done anything. So at that point, the abuser kicked his victim on the head and broke her neck and left her crippled for life. When I was a psychotherapist up in Lake County, a woman was referred to me by the head of the Victim Witness Program, an excellent court service which aimed to support battered women. My client had left her abusive husband and was in the midst of a divorce. Her estranged husband had been served with a protective order. She came in to her third session with me, profoundly upset. The night before, her abuser had broken into her apartment and threatened her with a gun. She managed to call the police, so he ran away. And then the police showed up, and they said we could take no action because he hadn't done anything. So the next morning, I called the head of the victim witness program to urge that the abuser be arrested for violating that protective order. And like the police, he said he couldn't take any action because the abuser hadn't done anything. I told him I'd personally sue him for dereliction of duty if her abuser ever showed up again. But at that point, this woman left her job and fled the state of California to save her own life. In some cases, the abuser is arrested, but the case is dismissed despite the very serious battering. The most common reason is that the woman would not, quote-unquote, cooperate. She would not come to trial and stand on the stand and give evidence. The reason why she won't cooperate most often is because she's being intimidated or cajoled for hours and days to withdraw her complaint, while she remains under threat because the abuser is out on bail. Another reason is the failure to properly evaluate the evidence. We now know that the two best predictors of a forthcoming murder are strangulation and stalking. Strangulation, that's just as serious as the use of a gun or a knife. If the abuser applies just 11 pounds of pressure to the victim's throat for 10 seconds, she'll go unconscious. If he applies 33 pounds of pressure, she'll be brain dead in about 4 minutes. If she survives strangulation, it's often the last physical abuse before she's murdered. And I particularly bring this up because it does come up in trials where before the murders, an abuser is on trial and he's attempted to strangle the victim and she manages to get away. But there are many times that it's a hung jury because people can't take seriously the acts that were going on. Then, stalking. Well, that's been called homicide in slow motion. About 76% of murdered women were stalked by their abusers, typically after divorce or separation. And the latest kind of stalking today is cyberstalking, where the victims are unceasingly attacked and threatened on the web. Now, a federal crime. In 2006, there were 2.5 million cyberstalking cases. The United States Justice Department pursued exactly 10 cases. But the biggest problem leading to the murder of women lies with prosecutors. In so many parts of the country, prosecutors have done all they could to dismiss cases, to divert cases to ineffective treatment for batterers, or reduce the charges. In 2012, San Francisco had the lowest prosecution rates in the United States for domestic violence, 25%. If the prosecution reduces the charges, for example, to disorderly conduct, the abuser gets to keep his guns. And then, if the prosecutors do bring a case to trial, all too often, the case is heard by a judge with learned helplessness. When the abuser is convicted, the sentence may range in different places from 60 days to 2.5 years. But judges often suspend these sentences with little time actually served. The offender is out of jail, and the victim is his target once more. Can we do anything to save the lives of women who call for help? You bet. First of all, there's the sphere of public action. We can learn about the laws and practices that must change, and we can push for those changes. We now know that specialized domestic violence courts may actually support abusers and ignore the threats to victims. And we know now that these diversion programs of counseling and group work for batterers save no lives. Let's support laws that make domestic violence a real crime and support the suing of members of the legal system, police, prosecutors, or judges when they fail to enforce the laws. And let's vote for guns, for laws that ban guns for abusers and close those loopholes that put lethal guns in their hands. Frank Lautenberg, a former senator, said the difference between a murdered wife and a battered wife is often the presence of a gun. Let's vote against political parties that block legislation that would save the lives of women. Secondly, we can turn to the friendships we have with women and find our voices and theirs. If we can speak up when we ourselves know about abuse by an intimate partner, if we can share in a space where we're safe and compassionate, others can put their experiences into words, often for the very first time. Out of this sharing, we can find healing and the power to join forces with those seeking to change the world. It's time to answer the needy when they call and to reach out to those who have no helper. It is time to redeem the lives that know oppression and violence. Spirit of love and life, give ear to those who cry out in their time of trouble and stir the hearts of all who would do justice for the oppressed. May it be so.